I'm Bob Oakes, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Authorities are investigating a growing identity theft scam involving a data collection agency that has information on virtually every American. The Georgia-based company, ChoicePoint, is now sending letters to 144,778 people nationwide because their information, culled from credit reports, motor vehicle records, even boat licenses, may have been stolen by con artists. Joining us on the line is Evan Hendricks, editor and publisher of the Privacy Times newsletter. Hi, Evan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Let me ask you, first of all, when the story first broke last week, ChoicePoint was only required under state law to notify residents of California whose identity may have been stolen, but there was such an uproar that the company's now notifying the 144,778 people in all states who may have been affected. Do you think that number will rise?
Yes, I think it will rise because we're only in the very early stages of the investigation, and we're expecting more announcements out of the West Coast this week.
Most people have never heard of ChoicePoint. What kind of business do they run? How do they have records on almost every American? And I know you know some of this because in your book you write about it.
Yeah, I have two chapters in my book, Credit Scores and Credit Reports, about ChoicePoint. They gobble up information from all the public records, the court records, the property tax records, so they know if you own your house and how much it's worth, auto purchasing records, voter records, licensing like guns and boats and all everything that's publicly available, which means it's subsidized by the taxpayers, they get at a very low price and they dump it into their database and build this incredible profile on virtually every adult American.
And what do they do with it?
Well, they sell it. They sell it to 40% of the top 1,000 companies. They sell it to 35 federal or state agencies, including law enforcement. They sell it to insurance companies. And they're in the post-9/11 world, they're into all these security background investigations as well as employment screening.
So what can scam artists do with the information that they've been able to pull out of ChoicePoint records? And I ask the question mindful of the fact that apparently after starting an investigation last year, police in California apparently found sacks of people's mail that had been redirected to the scammers.
Well, this fraud ring was very sophisticated because they understood that ChoicePoint was a gold mine for data, and in part because not only does ChoicePoint have its own data, but it's also a portal or a side door you can use to access the credit reports from the three major credit reporting agencies. So they were able to, I understand they were also working to change people's addresses, the victims' addresses, so they could use their name, use their Social Security number, and then have the goods sent to new fraudulent addresses.
We wanted to call a special hotline that ChoicePoint says it set up, but we couldn't because the number is apparently only available to the people whose identity may have been stolen, not all of whom have actually been notified by the company by letter yet. Can anyone phone ChoicePoint and find out if you're a victim or find out what kind of records they have on you?
As a practical matter, not really. ChoicePoint is not set up to be consumer-friendly and to disclose to you the information they hold about you. But this is something that's going to have to change, and that's why this whole episode might be a tipping point in getting Congress and our state legislatures to say, hey, if ChoicePoint has information about you and you ask for it, they have to give it to you. They're just not ramped up to do it right now.
ChoicePoint is apparently voluntarily taking steps to solve the problem, giving victims a year of free credit monitoring and stepping up its background checks on businesses who purchase information from them. Should there be more oversight of data collection agencies like this, Howard?
Oh, absolutely. And these steps that ChoicePoint announced are good opening steps, but Band-Aids are not going to solve this problem. We need a thorough congressional investigation so the public knows exactly what went wrong here.
And what steps can the average citizen do to ensure that the information isn't compromised?
Two words, credit reports. Get it, check it. Know when you're entitled to a free credit report so you don't have to waste money. We have a federal law where people in the West are already entitled. The Midwesterners will be entitled starting March 1st. Mark your calendar. Massachusetts is a free report state, as is in New Jersey and Maryland and Georgia. And you look in your credit report, you look at the inquiry section. You see what companies have accessed your credit report and for what reason. And if you're in Massachusetts and some car dealership in Texas has pulled your credit report, that's a red flag. Also look for an unfamiliar trade accounts in the credit history section of your credit report.
Evan Hendricks, publisher, editor of the newsletter Privacy Times, author of the book Credit Scores and Credit Reports. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And for more information, go to our website, here-now.org. A new documentary about U.S. combat troops in Iraq is scheduled to air tonight on PBS. The 90-minute Frontline program is called A Company of Soldiers, and it's sparking controversy not because of what's in the program, but because of what's been bleeped out. PBS asked the producers to provide a censored version of the film, cutting out profanity used by soldiers. Here's a clip.
Suddenly, they spot a car coming their way.
Morning, sir. Morning, sir.
Hey, so he passed the trigger line.
To the soldiers, it seemed like the driver accelerated after the warning shot. So the order was given to shoot directly at the car.
WGBH in Boston produced A Company of Soldiers, and station president Henry Becton joins us from their studios. Henry, let me start by saying thanks for joining us on Here and Now. How are you?
I'm fine, and thanks for inviting me on.
Let me ask you, first of all, what was the rationale that PBS gave you when it asked for a censored version of the film?
PBS is in a difficult position because they have to program for all the different licensees all over the country. And you've got to remember, public television is basically a local institution. We have 180-some-odd different owners, community foundations, universities, whatever, all around the country, and they each have different standards in their communities. So PBS is trying to program for what they see as the majority view of the standards of the stations. Now, the problem in this case is that the FCC threw everything, all the precedent of language use on television, up in the air last year with their Bono decision, and essentially created a very ambiguous situation where there are large potential fines for use of certain expletives on the air. And public television stations don't have a lot of money. They are chronically underfunded. They can't afford to run the risk of fines. So given that, PBS felt that this was the wiser course. Now, from our standpoint, we think that this is possibly the strongest case for including certain expletives on the air, and that ultimately the FCC will support this.
What makes it the strongest case?
We are showing this program is about the 8th Cavalry Dog Company in South Baghdad. It's a real and raw look at U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq, often in combat, always in danger. And as you can imagine, in the fog of war, in their Humvees being attacked, the language gets a little salty from time to time. And we believe our audience wants to know what it's really like. So we think it would be a disservice to the audience if we sanitize those moments of war. And ultimately, we think that this will not be ruled indecent.
So you are then not worried, at least at this moment, that WGBH will be fined for airing the program?
We aren't. We think the risk is small. If we were to be fined, we think ultimately we'd win it in the courts. And, you know, we produce about a third of the programming for the public television system. We really need to clarify these rules, and the only way you're going to clarify them is to take the strongest case and test it. And then if that clarifies it, you move on to the next case and test that.
While you're going ahead, are you, though, sympathetic to the concerns of smaller public TV stations, especially since Congress passed a bill last week that could increase indecency fines from $32,000 to $500,000? I mean, that would just break the bank for some stations.
Absolutely. We as I said, decisions are made at the local basis, and we respect every station's ability to decide what is right for its community. And some communities have very different standards than we do here in the Boston area. So we're very sympathetic to that.
What do you want from the FCC? Clear guidelines on how it decides what is indecent and or obscene?
Yes, I think until there are clear guidelines, there'll be an awful lot of self-censorship out of fear of these large fines that are possible. And with clearer rules, then we'll know where we stand. We'll know what's possible and what isn't possible.
Let me touch just briefly, if we can, Henry, on another controversy, another PBS controversy. Another WGBH program, Postcards from Buster, sparked some controversy last month over an episode that featured a lesbian couple. A children's program that features Buster the Bunny, who travels to different communities meeting people of diverse backgrounds.
Mom has arranged for you to spend some time with Karen.
Who's she?
She's a photographer who used to work with Mom. She lives here with her partner Gillian and their kids.
PBS pulled the episode following a letter from Education Secretary Margaret Spellings, who said that Congress and the Education Department did not want to introduce this type of programming to children. GBH aired the show and made it available to about 50 other stations willing to air it. Why did you decide to go ahead and air that program?
Well, first of all, this is a great series. This is meant to teach children about the diversity of America. We were responding to a request for proposals from the Department of Education right after 9/11 to create this series, and this episode is fully within the bounds of that request for proposals. It's done a great job of broadening the view of children across America. There are millions of kids in America who live in households headed by same-sex parents. We believe in the value of inclusion, and we want to help parents and caregivers raise children who are ready to learn, who are healthy and curious, and who are tolerant. This show is not about lesbianism or even gay marriage or sexual preference. None of that is mentioned anywhere in the program. It's in the background. So kids have no problem with it. It's really the adults bringing their adult lens to it that have issues with it.
PBS, of course, known long as a place where people can turn to for quality programming. How do you think these controversies affect viewer perceptions of the network?
Well, actually, it's sort of ironic because while these two controversies, and they're very different, obviously, have gotten a lot of press, public television is having a great season so far. Our audiences are up 11%. You know, Frontlines, for example, are up 57% this season. Most cable services and networks are down, and that includes the Discovery Channel and Home Box Office. The Learning Channel is down 33% in audience. There's a Roper survey that was just completed, and a lot of the questioning was done after the Buster controversy surfaced. That demonstrates that PBS is the most trusted media service in America, by far and away, followed by CNN.
But funding, of course, is in question. I mean, it seems like it's always under fire, especially in recent years. Congressman just last week at a congressional hearing questioning whether the government should continue to fund PBS. Education Secretary Spellings said that you can be sure the Education Department in the future will be more clear as to the expectation for future programming that it funds. Are you worried about future federal funding of programs?
Yes, I'm concerned because of the pressures in general on the budget. But congressmen hear from their local constituencies how much they value public broadcasting. The most popular program in the federal budget is public television and public radio.
Henry Becton, president of WGBH-TV, spoke to us from the station studio in Boston. Henry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bob Oakes. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about the public broadcasting system. Joining us now is Dan Kennedy, media critic of the Boston Phoenix. Dan, let me ask you first of all, how does all of this we've been talking about impact PBS's public image and then, I suppose, potentially its public support?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure we know the answer to that. I think that for many years we've had this image of PBS as being kind of this liberal bastion, and conservatives have complained about PBS as being kind of this outpost of liberal media. And now we're in this situation where it seems like we're getting a number of decisions that liberals are getting upset with. Most especially the Postcards from Buster episode. That did not leave a lot of liberal viewers and, more important, givers very happy at all.
this notion that the war documentary has to be sanitized, I think, is something that a lot of liberals feel offended by. And then you look at some of the more recent programming decisions, such as, you know, the addition of conservative commentators like Paul Gigot and Tucker Carlson. And so I think that, you know, PBS may be striving for balance, and that may be a good thing, but I think that some of their most ardent fans may be saying, what's going on here?
So in the final analysis, do you think that exhibiting restraint by offering to change programs will be viewed as a demonstration of PBS's responsibility and thus be considered in a positive nature or viewed more negatively by people who will consider it a demonstration of a willingness to be censored?
Well, one thing I wonder about and worry about is that you do have a conservative faction in Congress going back at least to Newt Gingrich's day, if not before, that would really like to do away with PBS altogether. So what I wonder is whether PBS, by making these concessions, is going to mollify their critics, or instead it's going to be seen as a sign of weakness, and now the people who would like to do away with PBS can go in for the kill. Quite frankly, I find the Postcards from Buster decision in some ways to be the most disturbing decision of all, because I understand that different parts of the country have different standards, and so maybe a more conservative part of the country wouldn't want to show an episode depicting lesbian couples and parenthood. But, you know, I mean, those are precisely the parts of the country where I think the kids in gay and lesbian households probably feel the most alone and the most isolated and the most in need of some sort of affirmation.
Well, PBS President Pat Mitchell has announced that she's going to step down when her current 3-year contract ends next year, although she hasn't made this link. Do you think it's a response to these pressures? Is it a direct result of the Buster flap?
I don't know if it's a direct result of the Buster flap, but as I understand it, she's already in her second term and she was deciding whether to go for a third term. And if she had decided that she'd had enough, I mean, who could blame her? These are not easy decisions to make. As critical as I am of the Buster decision, the fact is that does happen to be a show that was made with a great deal of government money. And so you've got the Secretary of Education being critical of that show. I think she was in kind of an impossible position. And I think maybe Pat Mitchell reached the point where she said she was tired of being put in impossible positions.
Is it a mistake for her to leave?
I don't think it's a mistake for her to leave because, she's been doing it for a while, and she'll have been doing it for a while more by the time she leaves in mid-2006. And, maybe the next person will bring in some fresh ideas for how to move this forward, just as she presumably did when she took over a few years ago.
Do you anticipate that PBS is going to go through, in the coming years, a major period of reconsidering what kinds of public programs it broadcasts, it produces and broadcasts, and the content of those shows?
Well, yes, and I think maybe the key word there is broadcast. The whole broadcast system, as us media junkies know, is based on the notion that broadcasting depends on the use of a limited public resource, the airwaves, and therefore there's a rationale for regulating it in the public interest, which is why we have these increasingly absurd indecency rules. Now, as scarcity ceases to be an issue, as we move into a 500 and a 5,000 channel universe, there really isn't any governmental rationale for regulating content. So I think that PBS, just like all programmers, have to think about what is this going to mean in the new world that we're moving into.
We also heard Henry Becton say that if he had his druthers, he would like more clear guidelines from the FCC on just what indecency or obscenity is. Do you think that that's going to happen? Do you think we're going to get a more clear indication from the FCC? I mean, certainly it's not not only the public broadcasters that want that, the commercial broadcasters want that as well.
Right. Well, let's distinguish between indecency and obscenity for a moment. Obscenity is simply speech that is not protected by the First Amendment, and so it really has no place on television or anywhere else under the law. Indecency, I don't think that there should be clearer standards, and the reason I say that is I was interviewing somebody on this very point a few months ago, and what he pointed out to me is if the FCC went with strict standards, the word crap would have been abolished a generation ago, and you still wouldn't be able to use it on TV. They're deliberately left vague to adjust to shifting cultural mores. It certainly creates a dilemma for today's broadcasters, but I think the result of trying to clarify them would be even worse.
Dan Kennedy, media critic for the Boston Phoenix newspaper, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate it.
And in the interest of full disclosure, Dan also contributes from time to time to the WGBH-produced program Greater Boston. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we look at the growing political unrest in Bangladesh. Some say the government is allowing radical Islamists to flourish. We'll talk with the daughter of a moderate politician who was assassinated in a grenade attack last month. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Over the long weekend, Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney was in South Carolina for a speech that was widely seen as his first foray into a run for the White House in 2008. In the speech, Romney stuck to traditional conservative positions on several issues, including gay marriage, stem cell research, and taxes. Romney downplayed speculation about a presidential bid, insisting he's focused on re-election to the Massachusetts governorship next year. Republican politicians around the country are focused on the 2006 midterm contest, hoping to use the momentum from last fall's election to widen their margins in Congress and in state capitals. For a look at what's ahead for the Republican Party, we turn to Ken Melman, President Bush's re-election campaign manager and now chair of the Republican National Committee. Ken Melman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Ken, let me ask you, first of all, looking back in order to look ahead, religious conservatives believe strongly that they won the November election for the GOP last fall. And I'm wondering at this point, what's the party owe them? A Supreme Court nominee who will stand against Roe v. Wade, or 2006 House and Senate candidates who support a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage?
Well, I think that religious conservatives, like the unprecedented number of Americans that supported the president in this past election, did so for a number of different reasons. Certainly the fact that the president reflected and respected their values was important. Also important was the president's leadership in the war on terror, the president's commitment to create prosperity in this country by reducing taxes, regulation, and lawsuits.
But you and I both know that people on the religious right, so to speak, have been actively saying in the past couple of months that they want more from the White House on their issues and not the general list of issues that won the White House for the GOP that you just articulated.
Well, I think, look, all of these are important issues. Certainly the president's commitment to strengthen marriage and the president's commitment to work for a culture of life were things he believed strongly in. He ran on in 2000 things where he worked hard on behalf of these issues over the last 4 years, and you'll see them over the coming years. My point is that what most folks who I speak with look for in this president is a strong leader who will confront the challenges our nation faces and will help transform challenges into opportunities.
Stepping back a little bit, what's tops on the agenda for you right now as the party head?
Well, obviously, working with the president, with the majority leader, with the speaker to accomplish the agenda we worked so hard for last year is very important. And not only is that important for the party, it's important to the country. The fact is, if you're 30 years old or under today, you don't have a secure Social Security system. I believe we have the opportunity through a personal retirement account in so doing not only to secure the system, but to make sure that we share the access to the American dream from an economic perspective with millions of Americans who don't have it today.
But you know that at least a handful of Republicans are out there, and I'm talking about Republicans in Congress, not Republicans living on Main Street USA, voiced their doubts that private retirement accounts are the way to go.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with them. I've not heard a lot of them that disagree with personal retirement accounts philosophically. I think that some wonder how we're going to explain it and want to make sure we do it in an intelligent and effective way, which we will do.
White House Chief of Staff Karl Rove told a group of conservatives last week that Republicans had, quote, seized the mantle of idealism and reform from the Democrats. Is the GOP, in effect, do you think, out-democrating the Democrats?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, and it's a good response to the last question we just asked. Look at some of the key questions of our day. Do you believe that poor parents all have access to the same choices and options in education that Senator Ted Kennedy and Senator John Kerry have? Republicans say yes. Some Democrats say yes, but a lot of the Democrat leadership say no. Do you believe that poor Americans ought to be able to build a nest egg, to save, to create wealth, to have access to the same kind of compound interest that Senator Ted Kennedy and Senator John Kerry have? Republican leadership says yes. Some Democrats hopefully will say yes, but right now too many Democratic leaders say no. I'm very proud of the fact that I believe that our president, a proud conservative, is today providing one of the great progressive forces in our nation and in our world. Look what he's doing over in Europe. An American president stands in Europe and proudly says there is no place for intolerance, there is no place for bigotry, there is no place for anti-Semitism in this world. So it seems to me that a leader that is leading our nation and the world saying everyone in this world deserves freedom, not just Westerners, every American ought to have access to the same choices in education, to the same kind of wealth creation that wealthy Americans have. When all those things are said by a president, it strikes me that president's doing a pretty good job of being both idealistic and also leading our nation forward.
I wonder if we could talk about campaign politics for just a moment in relation to the midterm elections in 2006. You're already on the record as saying that if possible, you'd like to expand the Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate in the midterm congressional elections in 2006. And I'm wondering if you could tell us how, in your head, you see the GOP penetrating the blue states out there.
Obviously, the 2006 elections are a tremendous challenge. This is the second off-year election in the president's term, which historically is one where the president's party has lost 7 seats in the Senate and 19 seats in the House. We're going to work very hard to avoid that from happening, and as you point out, we're going to work very hard to try instead to gain. How are we going to do that? We're going to talk about the agenda. We're going to work to expand and reach out further and bring new faces and new voices into the party. We're going to work to try to improve our political tactics that we used in the 2002 and 2004 campaigns for victorious results. And we're going to work as well as we can to encourage the best men and women all around the country to run for office.
Finally, Ken, I wonder if you'd comment on the election of your counterpart at the Democratic National Committee, former Vermont governor, former presidential candidate Howard Dean. Some say that Dean, perceived by many as left-leaning, could be the Republicans' best friend.
Well, look, I think Governor Dean is going to be a strong party chairman. He ran a strong race, raised lots of money, energized lots of people for the presidency. I called him when he was elected chairman, offered my personal congratulations on his victory. I think we have an opportunity for a robust debate in this country, and I'm certainly going to work as hard as I can as the RNC chairman to make sure that while we debate the issues vigorously, we do so in a personally respectful way. I hope Governor Dean will join me in that, and I think a lot of good can come out of these kinds of debates, and frankly, more people, as happened in 2004, can be inspired to vote and to participate and to volunteer and to donate and to be involved in public service. If more people are involved in public service, we will both, and both parties will have served the American people well.
Chairman of the RNC, the Republican National Committee, Ken Mehlman, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Still to come, we talk with the real-life subject of the Oscar-nominated film Hotel Rwanda. He rescued over 1,200 Tutsi refugees during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. You're listening to Here and Now. A fierce battle is being fought over MCI Communications. Last week, the struggling telecom company rejected a bid from Quest Communications and accepted a much lower offer from Verizon. But Quest isn't throwing in the towel just yet and is expected to announce a counteroffer in the next day or two. This buyout of MCI, formerly WorldCom, follows another recent telecom takeover, SBC's purchase of AT&T. Joining us with an update on this changing telecom landscape is Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills. Hi, Mark. Good to
see you.
Hello,
Bob. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. It seems that the next wave of mergers is taking place between telecom and cable giants. What's at stake?
Well, there's a lot at stake, and I think the mergers, Bob, mean that we're seeing kind of a clearing of the field, a winnowing of the weaker players, and a consolidation of the giants who are going to go at it, hammer and tong, to battle for communications into the home and business, whether it's video, text, internet, audio, data, everything is going to be going down the big pipe, and whoever controls that pipe is going to be the winner or the winners, and I think that's what we're seeing with the consolidation in telecom to be the big giants.
Let me ask you about the MCI deal. It is a little puzzling in some ways. MCI accepted a Verizon offer that was more than $1 billion lower than Quest's. Why?
Good question. And in fact, a lot of MCI shareholders are asking the same thing. And in fact, there are at least four shareholder lawsuits to stop the deal. The MCI executives, Michael Capellas is the CEO, felt that Verizon was a better partner. These deals involve purchasing MCI for a lot of stock, either Verizon stock or Quest stock. And the MCI officials feel Verizon is a more stable company, that Quest stock could be a little riskier to take as payment because their stock might drop before the deal is closed, and that would mean they'd actually get less. So there's a little bit of a risk in as to what stock you want to get paid in, because the deal could take a year or something to consummate.
I think Quest stock is worth something like $4 right now.
Yeah, it's been an iffy company. It's certainly weaker, a lot smaller than Verizon.
Why are Quest and Verizon so eager to acquire MCI?
Well, both Quest and Verizon are remnants of the Baby Bells. They're very strong in local phone service. And MCI, as is AT&T, is strong in business service and in services to business and in long distance. And so both Verizon and Quest would like to beef up those areas. And so they're picking off the players here, such as AT&T, which SBC acquired, and MCI, neither of which is likely would be likely to be able to go it alone. They need a bigger partner. And so the stronger companies are coming in to bulk up their businesses.
MCI's fate will be decided at some point, probably in the near future. Where's all this consolidation leading?
Well, the companies are bulking up for the big competition ahead. As communication goes more and more digital, companies that appear to be in different businesses are actually competing head-on. We have cable companies that are offering not only video programming, but broadband internet services and telephone services. And then we have telephone companies, or what we think of as telephone companies, that are also offering broadband and video programming as well. Many households have a telephone wire coming in one place and a cable wire coming in the other, if you think about it that way. And the question is, what wire is going to deliver the most service and which company is going to get the bigger check when the family pays its monthly bills? And the battle is over getting the big check.
So a company like Verizon wants to compete with Comcast or Time Warner to sell, for example, movies on demand?
Yes, they are. Verizon is wiring selected areas, ones that they think are affluent and are likely to be good customers, a high-capacity fiber that can carry video programming. They're also distributing DirecTV satellites, so they're going at it both with cable and satellite to try to get into the home television entertainment business, along with, of course, their traditional telephone services as well. And other players are getting in as broadband becomes more widely adopted in the home. Companies like Yahoo are going Hollywood, and they're going to be producing programming and trying to get you to buy things from Yahoo.com.
Beyond consumers, how are business customers affected by all the consolidation?
Some businesses are worried that as we have consolidation, competition will dwindle and prices may rise. But you know what? There's so many other new things going on out there with voiceover internet, for example. There's a company like Vonage that has started up to sell telephone services on the internet, a lot of people making wireless calls. So even though we're seeing consolidation, there's still a lot of options for businesses as well as consumers.
Mark Mills, thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. This is Bob Oakes. It's Here and Now. The dramatic film Hotel Rwanda has been nominated for 3 Academy Awards, Best Screenplay, Best Supporting Actress, and Best Actor. Don Cheadle is being recognized for his portrayal of Paul Roussus Abagina, the hotel manager who saved the lives of over 1,200 men, women, and children during the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Paul's 4-star hotel became a sanctuary for terrified Tutsi refugees, hiding from the machete-wielding, gun-toting Hutu army. Robin Young spoke with the film's director, Terry George, and the real-life Paul Roussus Abagina when the film was released late last year. We'll get to that interview in a moment, but first in this scene, family and staff at the hotel listen to the radio as the slaughter of the Tutsi people is launched.
Listen to me. Good people of Rwanda, terrible news. Our great president is murdered by the Tutsi cockroaches.
Oh,
they tricked him to sign their phony peace agreement. Then they shot his plane from the sky. It is time to clear the brush, good Hutus of Rwanda.
It's a pleasure to have both, Terry. Hello.
Thank you.
And the real-life Paul Roussus Abagina in our studios. Hello to you, Paul.
I'm fine.
And you know, and when I met you a few minutes ago, it's very emotional to meet you. You are quite a hero. With this movie coming out, do you feel this sense of appreciation for what you did?
The ovation after each and every screening, people are receptive to the message we are conveying.
We want to find out what that message is, but you are a Hutu. Your wife is a Tutsi. You're in the home in that opening scene where you hear on the radio about the death of the president. The militia arrives. You're useful to a military man because you can help his soldiers get rooms at the hotel. He drives you and your family there. You bribe him several times to save their lives. But I want to ask you, do you remember those first horrific hours of the slaughter? As you drive to that hotel during that day, what were you thinking? What were you seeing?
Well, already from home because we were stranded. And I stayed in my house for 3 days before being evacuated from my house to the hotel. I had about 26 refugees, as you can see in the movie. And those refugees, I couldn't leave them at my home. I took them as my family. And on my way, on the streets and the roads, we were seeing dead bodies. And at about 1.5 kilometers, I was stopped by the captain who came to take us from home to the hotel. And he handed me a gun and told me, kill all of these cockroaches of yours.
And this was your wife, your children, her family?
And I had to negotiate with them for about 2 hours.
And you did. You used your wiles on your feet. Later, you got money from the safe at the hotel and began paying off the Hutu militia.
They wanted money from each and everyone. But I told them, look, you are asking them what they don't have. The only person who has got money and me, I have money in the safe.
In the
hotel.
Boy, I mean, just such bravery. And also, Terry, I'm thinking, as I'm watching those scenes, well, he could have given them the money and they could have killed him and the story would have been over right there. When you first heard Paul's story, your thoughts about what he did?
Well, obviously, you know, it struck me right away that this was the heroism epitomized in it was amplified even more by the fact that here was an ordinary man who took the skills that he had learned and obviously was very good at as a hotelier and turned that into this amazing feat of bargaining with killers and army generals and persuading them and dissuading them in order to save all the refugees who had fled to his hotel.
Mm. Paul, tell us about that, because it's one thing you brought your family and your neighbors to the hotel as the slaughter's continuing around the hotel. What then happened? How did other people know to come there?
Well, when I arrived in the hotel, there were some refugees already. Mm-hmm. And the ones I knew where they were still hiding, I sent them. I tried to organize and send them soldiers to go and bring them to the hotel.
Mm. I want to play a clip from the movie Hotel Rwanda. And in this scene, Paul, the character that is you, finds out that the Hutu army wants to kill not only the men and women, but the children as well. Let's listen.
They're targeting Tutsi children, Paul, to wipe out the next generation. I've nowhere to take the orphans, Paul.
Don't worry. There will be an intervention force coming soon, and we will get the orphans out of them.
Paul, did you and other Rwandans think that someone would come and help you, that there would be intervention?
Well, from the day that the United Nations pulled out, there was no more hope. I know I will die. That one I was sure. Mm-hmm. They will kill me before killing these people because they knew I was the only person protecting the refugees. But before I die, I was supposed to go up to the end of my strength. I said, I won't give up.
Right. Well, as you said, the UN and international peacekeeping forces did leave days after that conversation. The U.S. didn't intervene. Belgium, South Africa, every country now is ashamed of what they didn't do then. But what did you do? How did you had thousands of hundred men and women and children in your hotel. What did you do?
Well, I was facing a lot of problems. I was trying to get food. I was rationing water because I knew it was the only treasure which was remaining for us.
Paul Rusesabagina, you bluffed your way for 100 days. In the final moments, you and 1,200 refugees were rounded up for execution, but we're not going to tell the real-life ending. Suffice it to say, you did not lose a single soul, even though a million Rwandans were slaughtered outside of the hotel. You say you now have a message. What is that?
I know that the average citizen of each and every nation in the Western world is not informed of what happened in Rwanda, is not informed of what is happening right now in Sudan. They are not informed of what is happening in Congo, where people have been butchered for the last 80 years. It is the same thing in northern Uganda and Burundi. This movie, I take it as a kind of wake-up call to our consciences so that we can prepare a better world for the next generations.
Terry, just a last thought, just watching the movie, a lot of people in the West could comfort themselves with the thought that, oh, well, these were people who fight all the time and it's Africa. In your film, you see this beautiful man in his suit and tie working at a hotel with his lovely family. They look like us.
When I visited Kigali, I saw that, and that's what I wanted to recreate, that this was not two bunch of savages, you know, killing each other with machetes and clubs. This was a growing country. Paul led a sophisticated, westernized life. There were many people like him. And suddenly, this complex political situation, manipulated by hate radio, turned a civil war into a genocide. And that's the purpose of the film, to take people inside that and follow through the genocide, through this terrible event, with one man who gives us hope and inspiration. Mm.
Terry George's film is called Hotel Rwanda. It tells the story of Paul Rusesabagina, the inspiration for the film. Paul, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
It's a remarkable story. Terry, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And the film Hotel Rwanda is nominated for 3 Academy Awards. The winners will be announced Sunday night. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Emiko Tamagawa, Matt Largy, Stefano Katsonis, and Kevin Sullivan. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer, assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer is Shannon Mullen, and our interns are Danielle Dreilinger and Kate Goldring. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.